Accession number 30633, Mr. James Fox, Reel 11. Now, so what happens next? You sort of established this routine. How are you getting on with your man? You said you had no trouble, but this is a troupe you had for a long time. Were there any characters amongst them? I mean, did you get to know them by name? What was important to you about leadership, do you think?
There were certainly some strange characters.
Strange in what way?
Well, particularly in the first regiment, there were some very crude, scruffy gunners. There was a chap who never buttoned up his battle dress properly and used to come back in the evening with a piece of newspaper with fish and chips in it inside the front of his battle dress, feeding himself. He got into endless trouble by being scruffy and not looking after his uniform and things like that. There was another man who kept on absenting himself, and the story was that he couldn't resist a woman with a large bust. And every time he saw one, he locked onto her, and if necessary, followed her for miles and didn't come back for several days. I wish I could remember their names now. I almost can. There were other. I mean, there was. Otherwise, there weren't very odd characters, but there were people who one respected for their difference from others. For instance, our troop clerk.
Now, which troop is it?
This is H Troop 444.
This is you.
Yes. Gunner Way was a very gentle, quiet Devonshire man with a terrific Devonshire accent, and he was head teacher of a small school, a village school somewhere in Devon, Biddeford, or in North Devon, I think. He was much liked by everybody. Names come back. I mean, I could go on for ages talking about odd members of the troop. But we became a good body of friends, really. I don't remember any hostility of any sort. The only person much disliked by everybody was Peter Darcy, who was the troop commander. He was a Yorkshireman. He'd been a refrigerator salesman before joining up. I think he was probably a territorial as well. He was a bit of a martinet. And he, of course, when that regiment, before its mobile training, it was like all the others of those days, with four guns and just a subaltern in charge of the troop. So he was Mr. Darcy, and he was always very incensed when the gunners always called him Mr. DRC. And even after he'd become a captain, they still called him Mr. DRC, and this offended him very much. I remember he was very much on his high horse about it. And he was a strange character.
In what way?
I think he was probably very unsure of himself, for one thing. But my fellow subaltern and I, we were great friends.
Now, who was he?
He was called Mike Morgan, W.M. Morgan. His father had a tin plate works at Llanelli in South Wales, privately owned in those days, but eventually nationalised, of course. And Michael had been at a public school. He'd been at Charterhouse. He was a little younger than me. And we had very similar backgrounds and got on extremely well together. And we both found Peter a slight nuisance. I mean, he was inclined not to allow us enough freedom. And he would. One of the I've always found annoying things is when you were just going to do something and your commander assumed you weren't going to and told you to do it. And you just took the wind out of your sails. But he was rather like that. He it's much later on in the story, he was killed, and so was Mike. But
now, what about the NCOs?
NCOs, they were a varied bunch, but they were all quite good. I think the regiment had been, I mean, they'd rarely sorted everything out in the mobile training, and they made sure that they had a reasonably good number of men, efficient men. And there was I don't remember any problems within gun detachments and that sort of thing, of them not getting on together. The sergeants were, let me just think, Sergeant Fleming, Sergeant Farmborough, Sergeant Knight, who was very young, tall, thin, very smart, and two other sergeants, Sergeant Edwards, who was a gamekeeper in civilian life, and who I met after the war by chance again, where he was gamekeeper to somebody I knew. They were all, in their different ways, good enough.
Were they helpful to you as a still a fairly inexperienced young officer?
Yes. It's difficult to remember detail. Whether they would have had requests of various kinds, no doubt, and I would have done my best to deal with them. I think they completely trusted us. Once we were overseas, of course, we had to censor their letters.
Oh, well, we'll come to that.
Yes.
You didn't censor them in this
country? Not in this country, no.
So are you in action much, or again, are you not? Are you generally a precaution, you know?
Yes, I should say that we were virtually never in action.
What, at Tynemouth? No German raids on Tynemouth?
No. If there were raids, they were the planes were too high for us to be involved. I mean, our range was a mile and a quarter or something, and vertically much less than that, so that we were really only useful for fairly close targets, and there were very, very few of those.
So they had to be basically attacking where you were, at low level.
Yes, and so, broadly speaking, we were never in action. I think there was just once, when we were at Portsmouth.
That's it. We'll come to that later.
Then. Yes.
So, anything else happened at Tynemouth? You've got to go.
At Tynemouth? No, absolutely nothing. And after.
You Tynemouth, were there a while, weren't you?
We were there for a couple of months or something, perhaps. And I think where on earth we went next? We certainly went to practice camp at Aberarran.
How do you spell that?
Aberarran. That's
in Wales, I presume.
Yes. The practice camp was up on the hillside on high ground overlooking the sea, about a mile from a little, tiny little seaport. Very pretty place, now a great tourist attraction called Aberarran. And we were there for, I suppose, 3 weeks. That would have been
what
some.
What did you do there? What sort of exercises? What training?
The main object, of course, was to fire the guns, to get practical experience of firing the guns at a towed target. These drogues towed on a rope behind a Miles Master or one of these small planes which flew to and fro. And that, of course, was only in good, reasonably good weather. And there were terrible wet days when we did next to nothing, just sat around.
And could you hit the drogues?
I can't remember anybody ever hitting a drogue. Yes, this unfortunate event that I'd mentioned at Watchet with the previous regiment, when the chap fell on the gun and fired it, of course, did create quite a stir, because the gun, in fact, achieved what was called a plus on the plane rather than the drogue, the towing plane. And a plus, I forget the technology of it now, but it was, if you got a plus and you fired again immediately, the next one would get nearer to hitting the target, and perhaps the third one would actually hit the target. And so it was a near thing for the poor pilot of the towing plane. But otherwise, I remember no problems that at all.
Did you practice firing barrages, or is it not a barrage weapon? I'm not sure it is.
I can tell you about barrages when we got to the continent.
Okay.
But no, not at that stage at all. I think I'm pretty sure I'm right in saying that.
So you were an aimed weapon?
Yes.
Or predicted, or this
at that stage with the stiffy stick.
Yeah, there wasn't a barrage structure that you'd follow, you know.
I don't think there was ever a barrage structure in this country, but I'm not absolutely sure of that.
Well, we'll take it as that. I think.
Yes.
So after you went to the practice camp, the firing camp.
Yes.
Anything happened there that you remember, or was it?
No, that was in early spring, probably February. Where are we? 44. I get confused about this.
43, I think.
43 was when I...
It depends how
yes,
long
you... Early 43 was when I was... early 43 was when I moved to 444 battery at Lyon-Sea.
That was in January.
Then we went to Dinmouth. So perhaps it would have been in March or something like that.
That sounds more likely.
Yes,
if you were
that we went to practice camp. I've got it all... All recorded where we went from place to place. I simply can't remember at the moment. But we went around nearly always coastal places of one sort and another, and just did the same thing everywhere.
In that case, it's probably best to just look at what you. Are there any particular incidents you remember from that, from your movements? So you were moving generally. As you say, every 2 weeks on average.
Yes.
Through 43, 44.
Yes. We were stationed... we went up to Cleethorpes, of course, twice. On different occasions. We were in Margate twice. We were in Worthing, Selsey Bill, and East and West Wittering, along the coast south of Chichester. That was the summer of 44. Perhaps if we jump forward to 44, because things...
It's the next thing you remember, you know, that's
yes,
different.
Things were went on being very much the same, with training exercises alternating with periods just deployed defending somewhere. And in the spring of 44, we were in Northumberland at... Millfield, which was a tactical Air Force training aerodrome. The tactical Air Force was being developed by the RAF then, and they were the fighters that would be with the forward troops, on the forward landing grounds and so on. We were sent up to, we drove all the way up there in snow and encamped on the edge of this aerodrome. Absolutely blissful surroundings, right at the foot of the Cheviot Hills. And our duty was one of the nicest things we ever had to do. We were sent there to demonstrate to the fighter pilots the sort of protection they were going to get in forward landing grounds. And the way we did it, there we fired barrages, but they were not very well-constructed barrages, really just a group of guns all firing simultaneously, I think. And we simply poured tracer up into the sky to give them a sense of security. I don't know how much they've benefited from it, but it was a wonderful chance for our gunners, of course. They absolutely loved it. Their complaint always was that they never, in fact, had anything to do. They were trained and trained and trained for a job that never happened. And so... that was very nice, and during that period, which was probably only a fortnight, seems they were long periods, but in fact they were quite short very often. I remember the climate change. It was beginning of March 44, and we arrived there under canvas in snow, And there was a sudden thaw, and in a matter of a couple of days, we were on dry ground in our shirt sleeves and a beautiful warm spring weather. And we were then ordered south. We didn't know how long we were going to be there. I mean, there was no timetable. But suddenly, we picked up sticks. Off we went south, travelling in convoy, and putting up two or three places for the night on the way. That was the occasion when I particularly remember staging at Nebworth, when I had to take all the guns to Bedford to get all the lorries to get them refuelled. Coming back, couldn't find my batman, who had set up my bed somewhere but wasn't there to tell me where, so I had to sleep in full uniform and a leather jerkin lying on a duckboard, which was about the most unpleasant night I've ever spent, I think. Terrible backache. And we then went on. At that stage, I was shepherding the column on motorbike, and so was my Mike Morgan, my fellow subaltern. And we, oh yes, another interesting point. When travelling convoy through London, the column was halted at a boundary point, somewhere out in the outer suburbs, perhaps a little south of Hatfield or somewhere like that, or on the Great North Road. And a posse of Metropolitan Police motorcyclists took over. And the whole system changed in a dramatic way. They made us close up, nose to tail. We didn't go 30 miles an hour, we went about 50 miles an hour, as fast as we could make the gun tractors go. And they took us right through the centre of London. I remember going right past St. Paul's Cathedral. And the night before, I think when we were at Nebworth, orders were changed. We didn't know why we were going south then, but I think we were told that we were going to Norwood. And the reason we were going to Norwood was in order to deploy to fire at Doodlebugs, at V1s. And this was a scare. The V1s, in fact, didn't appear for another two or three months. And so I think it was quickly discovered that the Germans weren't ready to begin firing them, or we'd managed to, the Air Force had managed to destroy their launching ramps or something. So we were then diverted to Margate. That was our second visit there. And that's why we went through the city of London, down through Kent, encamped at Margate without a roll. We were just billeted there. And by very good fortune, we were bombed there, and at least one of our gun tractors was damaged.
Now, what do you remember about the bombing? Where were you and what happened?
I might have been with fellow officers at a pub in Ramsgate or something. I don't really remember the event happening at all, except the after effects. The sort of thing that every unit hoped would happen to them without casualties, because you could then claim that all the stuff that had gone missing had been destroyed by the Germans, and you got replacements. People had lost their rifles or something or other, you know. There were awful deficiencies here and there, and we made them all up. And I remember that my battery commander, Peter Barnett, managed to acquire an extra Lewis gun, which he had mounted on his Jeep. And he went round standing in the Jeep with the Lewis gun at the ready and all sorts of things like that. And I think I missed out an important stage. We'll go back to that in a moment. Where did I got? Oh, yes, we were from Margate. We were then, we made our way, I can't remember, that was in late March or early April. D-Day was on the beginning of June. So sometime in the intervening period, we went to Hedge End, Botley, in Hampshire, which was the centre of the strawberry growing area.
Botley.
Actually, the parish we were in was called Hedge End, and we were, again, we were not deployed, we were just camping. And There we waited for some considerable time, strawberries ripening, the strawberry grower saying, go and pick as many as you like. And all the gunners spent their time picking and ripening strawberries. It was within reach of my home. I was allowed to go off on my motorbike quite often to spend a night at home. And we were, by then, we knew that we were going to be sent over on D plus three.
Now, what was the thing you said you'd missed out?
Oh, that was...
Before we got, you know, get then.
That was a Lark Hill Depot Regiment. Now, that was in the summer of 43. Do you want me to start?
Yeah, let's do that now. So
all right. We were chosen, I suppose, to take our turn as what was known as Depot Regiment at Lark Hill, which meant that a regiment provided its three batteries in turn, a month each.
So this is a school of artillery?
School of artillery, yes. And the battery was then available for the instructors to call for groups of troops, one sort or another, either full deployment, or full parade, or just small groups of people going out, taking them out to demonstrate map reading even, and things like that.
And so you were the demonstration?
Yes, and that was absolutely farcical. One of the reasons why our CO was replaced. That
What went wrong?
Well, just before that, our guns had been fitted. This was a modification to all mobile Bofors guns, fitted with armor-plated screens in front of the two layers, who previously had just sat at their wheels, and if anything had fired a gun at them, they would have been shot. And these are plates, very especially chemically treated, so that they didn't shine or anything like that, and painted with a dull camouflage paint, the usual sort of, you know, green and brown sort of thing. We were under orders not to polish equipment in any way, not even to polish the buttons on our uniform or anything, because we might draw attention to enemy aircraft. And when Colonel Powell learnt that we were going to be depot regiment, he got us all polishing. All the paint was taken off the front of the gun shields. They were polished so that they were shining silver. You would hardly believe it. And when the regiment marched into Lark Hill, I suppose it was the first battery, came in with officers standing in the fronts of the vehicles with their bodies up through the hip ring in the roof, all scanning the horizon with binoculars and all sorts of things, as if they were a sort of mock going into action, and the guns all gleaming and shining. And the most frightful row about it, because the instructors were nearly all bright young majors with the MC, who'd just come back from the desert after Alamein. And they were used to a very different kind of warfare. I was, two of us, a chap called John Harrison and I, were picked out to do special tasks. Now, John Harrison was a wireless, an officer in charge of wireless communication or something, and I can't remember what on earth he had to do. He and I shared a room in the RA mess, while everybody else were in sort of spider blocks up at the back. And my job was to be liaison officer between the regiment and the school. And I had to report every morning to a hut on the edge of the camp in which the dear old man called Daddy Bramall, I rather think he was father of Field Marshal Lord Bramall more recently, a nice old boy who seemed to me in his 70s or something, probably in his 50s really, and he, I don't know what his title was, but he sort of ran the whole training system. I mean, he received the requests from the instructors for what they wanted for the day's training exercises and so on, gave me the details of what were required, and then I went to the battery commander of the depot battery to say what was wanted. And I had remarkably little to do, in fact. And after work in the evening, I lived in the RAMS, of course, but we used to have lectures in the open air. I can't remember what on earth they were about. I remember sitting around in the grass listening to lectures, and the only thing I particularly remember, of course, we fed in the RAMS, lived in style compared with all the other members of the regiment. I can remember this notorious fearsome real martinet, General Revel Smith, who was, I don't know, can't have been head of ADGB, because that was Sir Keith Park or someone, I think, a general. But Revel Smith perhaps was what was in charge of the mobile regiments. But he had a big command, anyhow. He was a staff officer, and he came down to visit the school and arrived at the hut where Daddy Bramall was and I was sitting, and he said, "I want to go and visit the depot regimental commander. I'd like to be taken there." So Daddy Bramall said, "Mr. Farquharson, would you mind taking the brigadier?" In a sort of feeble voice. And so I got up from my chair, and Revel Smith said, come on, man," that sort of thing. And I went out, got into his command car. He got in on the other side. Unfortunately, when I got in, I sat on his Sam Brown, which was lying on the seat. That didn't make me popular for a start. It was the most embarrassing occasion. It only lasted very briefly, because I delivered him, I think, to the battery headquarters, where no doubt the battery commander then suffered from Revel Smith's fierceness. And there must twice have been a handover between one battery and the next. And what the rest of the regiment was doing during that period, I have no idea now. They must have been somewhere or other within reach, each waiting its turn, or one having had its turn and gone back. So that was the summer of 43.